This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When someone close to you tells you they have been diagnosed with a serious illness, your first reaction is shock. Your second is to say something appropriate. But what is appropriate? Inevitably, you will probably offer to do whatever you can. You'll hear these words coming out of your mouth. If there's anything I can do. And as they escape your lips, you can't imagine what that might be. It seems that no matter how much we empathize, we really don't know what to say or do. Or do we? Josephine Hicks' partner was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Over the 4 years of her partner's illness, she became the primary caregiver. But she and her partner also did something intriguing. They began taking notes on all of the things people around them said and did that were helpful. Well, now, Josephine Hicks, an attorney by trade, has put many of those notes into a small but powerful book, If There Is Anything I Can Do, What You Can Do When Serious Illness Strikes, and she joins us now. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
You know, you're here with two other people who I will now introduce, and this is the happiest group that's been on this program in a very long time. And given the topic that we're about to discuss, I don't understand, but perhaps I will by the end of the hour. Now, Louise Goldstein is a registered nurse and clinical care coordinator with Duke Home Care and Hospice. She did not know Josephine or Anne, but she ended up playing a role in editing this little book. And in fact, today, I understand, is the first time that you have met Josephine in person.
Yes.
I would never have known that from the conversation that was going on when I walked into this room. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And John Munce, is the person who got Louise Goldstein involved in the process of making this book a reality. A friend of Josephine and Anne's, he is a cancer survivor himself, a former patient of Goldstein's who found himself on the receiving end of the statement, if there's anything I can do. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Nice to have you. I'm sure that when Anne was diagnosed, you and she heard more times than you can count, if there is anything I can do, and it's right after the diagnosis and right after you told your friends, did you believe at that point there was anything they could do?
That's a great question. When we first got the diagnosis, you know, first heard the words, you have a tumor on your pancreas, that certainly sent us into a rapidly changing world, turned our world upside down, and it all changed very rapidly. You have a tumor, became you need a procedure right away, which became it's operable, your surgery is a week from tomorrow. And I was completely overwhelmed. I had never been through anything like this before, and of course people immediately started saying, if there's anything I can do. And I frankly didn't know what I needed for people to do to help. So I didn't quite know how to react to that other than to say, well, thank you very much and keep going. But what really struck me early on is that some people knew exactly what to do, little things that were remarkably helpful. Mm. Other people really did not know what to do and just threw out there, if there's anything I can do, let me know, with a press of the arm and a very sincere voice, and was really well-intended and sincere. Other people did things that were well-intentioned that turned out not to be so helpful.
Did that happen quickly? Because I was going to ask you at what point you realized that, at least in some cases, this was more than a platitude. People actually could help and did help. At what point did you really begin to realize that?
I realized that right away because people did some things that never would have occurred to me that were very helpful. For example, one of my law partners whose husband had had brain cancer and had been through what we were facing, the day before Anne's surgery, she left a bag on our front porch with puzzles and magazines and pencils. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, thank you, and I took it with me. But I had this vision that I was going to have lots of time in the hospital, and I was carrying around a team of rivals. And, well, of course I had no time to read something like that. She knew what I didn't know, which is that time in the hospital is interrupted, it's anxious. The nurse is coming in, the doctor's coming in, you're worried, the patient suddenly needs something. You don't have time to read a long biography or novel. At best, you have time to flip through a magazine or work a puzzle or something like that. And we kept that set of magazines and puzzles in her room, and other people who sat with her could look at them if they wanted to. It was a little thing, but it was enormously helpful.
Yeah.
And lots of people did things like that right away, really from the get-go.
And there must have been a lot of people, because you're an attorney with a high-profile practice here in Charlotte. And who was Anne? Talk about Anne.
Ann was at that time working at Bank of America, but she first came to Charlotte as an Episcopal priest, and she had lots of friends and lots of colleagues and people she had ministered to in her ministry and people she had worked with at the bank. She was a remarkable woman, really, in many ways. She was exceedingly bright. She was a wonderful preacher and teacher. She was very caring. She was very much put relationships and family ahead of her own career and ambitions, even though she was quite accomplished in her career. Mm-hmm. But she was well-known and well-loved in Charlotte, and we did have a lot of friends who were ready to do anything we needed at a moment's notice.
She also had a gift of conversation. You write in the book that she could meet a perfect stranger and in a nanosecond know everything about them and strike up this wonderful two-way dialogue. That's challenging for a lot of people. And when a lot of people, even if they know you well and you've had many conversations, when something terrible happens to you, they don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, and they begin to just kind of distance themselves because it's uncomfortable for them.
Right.
What would you say to them?
I would say step into the awkwardness, get beyond that, and just talk to the person and let them set the tone. If you don't know whether they're going to feel comfortable talking about the disease, let them set the tone. Ask an open question like, how's it going? Tell me about it. Mm-hmm. They'll pick what it is that they're mm-hmm. ready to tell you about. If they want to talk about basketball or gardening, that's fine. But they may want to talk about the disease. They may want to talk about their fears, their hopes, and just listening to them and letting them tell their story is an enormous gift.
Louise, you were nodding when I was asking the question, and, mm-hmm. you continue to do so. So obviously, you have, and this is what your job is. You work in hospice and have for years.
Yes.
Talk about this.
So I think it's okay to say I don't know what to say to you at this time, but I want to be here, or I want to be with you, or if it's okay. And I think that's a great thing to do. If you're able to be with someone else's pain and sorrow and grief and fear and can hold that place, that's fantastic. A lot of people can, a lot of people can't. But the good intention and honesty at that time is, I think, really appreciated. Excuse me. As a nurse, I'm allowed into people's lives, not knowing them at all, at the most intimate and vulnerable time perhaps ever. And
you point out also that as a nurse, mm-hmm. you have to deal with people that you would never associate in real life
perhaps.
With, in many cases, but you deal with them equally as though they were your best friend.
Absolutely.
So that gives you, I think, a distinct perspective on this.
Absolutely. And I think it's a phenomenon of nurses who are bedside caregivers that you come in contact with people at this incredibly vulnerable time and you are allowed in and requested to come in. And if you can build and something happens, it's not even something that you consciously do. It's just a connection or a love builds at this time with people that you perhaps otherwise, if you were walking down the street with them, might cross to the other
right.
side. But it's this amazing opportunity to be with all of these people.
And John, you bring a special perspective to this because not only were you a friend of Anne's and obviously a friend of Josephine's, but therefore on the what can I do to help end of things, you had cancer, and so people came to you with that same response, and many of them perhaps were not comfortable. So how did you deal with that?
Well, the interesting experience from the patient's point of view is that as soon as you say that you've got cancer, there's a moment where they look at you like you're already dead. It's, I'm so sorry. And you can tell that they really, even if they end up
What does that feel like to be on the receiving end of that?
It feels inside you're saying, I'm not dead yet.
Monty Python.
Or sometimes outside you're saying that.
That's true.
Right. That's right. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's all right. I guess the thing that I learned is you have to be patient with them because like at church, there are people that I know and deal with and have known for years, and there's something about that response that you just have to suck it up for as the patient. The harder part I found was for the people that then began to tell you about their Uncle Harry's horror story or, my sister Lou didn't have your kind of cancer, but she had one, and it was really terrible and miserable. And
why do you think people do that? That just sounds like, on the face of it, a stupid thing to say to somebody who's about to go through hell and back with cancer treatment. Is it just because they're nervous and they don't know what to say and it just involuntarily comes out? What is that about?
I think it's about that's in their file folder under the word cancer.
Yeah.
'Cause I've had that reaction myself, even after I've been through this, where I have to bite my tongue because my first reaction is say, oh, yeah, I knew somebody who had this, that, and the other. But it just tumbles out.
Yeah. And which is the bigger camp? People who can who deal with this, friends who can come to you and say, what can I do, and actually do things, or the people who are uncomfortable with it and would just rather not have to have it as part of their lives?
I think certainly more people are uncomfortable with it than are comfortable and know what to do. But people do sincerely want to help. And I've had so many people tell me that the book actually was very helpful because it gave them ideas. And now instead of saying to somebody, let me know what I can do, they'll say, I can walk the dog. Let me walk the dog this afternoon.
Now you actually say, don't ask the question.
Right.
Just do it.
Just do it. Or just offer to do something specific. And even if they don't take you up on it, it tells them that you really are thinking about them and you really care. I had an opportunity or an occasion once at work, a colleague stopped me in the hall and said, I got the oil changed in my car yesterday, and it occurred to me that it's probably hard for you to get to things like that. Please let me know if I can do that for you. I never asked him to do anything to help us, but it was clear that he really was thinking about us. It wasn't just a platitude, oh, I'm thinking about you. He clearly was, and he wanted to help, and he offered something specific, and it meant a lot to me. I'm still telling that story 7 years
later. So it is the thought that counts.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, on a high level.
Yeah.
And I think it's also interesting, John, that you just a minute ago said how when people say things perhaps they hadn't thought through so clearly,
right,
that you had to be we should be patient with them. And it's interesting how the patient who is burdened with all of this also then becomes burdened with having to tell people what to do,
right,
when they say, is there anything else I can do? And so if you can, as Josephine's book, which is so fantastic and is so concrete recommendations, has so many of them in such a kind way of suggesting to people that these are things you might do, and it really, I think, changes everything when someone will say, as opposed to saying, I was thinking about, whatever, saying, I'm bringing you dinner on Thursday, or I'll bring you fruit on Wednesday, or I'll come by in the morning and pick up your paper or walk your dog. Or
see, it
something.
Seems to be a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you say, don't ask the question, what can I do? Just do something. Or say, I'm going to do this for you. And you just mentioned three examples of things that people could do on a certain day at a certain time, certain different things.
Right.
What if you don't want them to do that? We have to take a break. We'll come back and get an answer to that question in just a couple of seconds. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Area Transit System. Public transit benefits more than just commuters. It also creates jobs through private development, which generates tax revenues for schools, roads, and more. Details at ridetransit.org. We're going to get our quarterly look at the North Carolina economic forecast tomorrow. We've been doing this every quarter since the Great Recession began. Things are looking up, as John Connaughton said they would. He's the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. We'll take a little twist on this tomorrow, however. We're going to take a look at the ongoing debate about minimum wage and the situation in North Carolina with cutting off unemployment benefits, because it seems like it's becoming a template for the rest of the country. We'll take a look at that and the effect of policy on the economy tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Senate approves a bill to strengthen protections for military sexual assault victims, and a Fort Bragg judge refuses to dismiss sex assault charges against an Army general. New developments in how military sexual assault cases are handled.
You can join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Josephine Hicks is with us. She is the author of If There's Anything I Can Do, What You Can Do When Serious Illness Strikes. It's a volume that stems from an experience that she and her partner had with, when her partner was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. John Muntz is also with us, a cancer survivor and a friend of Josephine and Anne's. Anne Louise Goldstein is a registered nurse and clinical care coordinator with Duke Home Care and Hospice, who has extensive background in helping people with this. I forgot the question I was going to ask right out of the break. Here's the question. What if somebody volunteers, I will do this for you, but you don't want them to do that for you?
You have to be willing to say, thank you very much, but we don't need that. And that was a learning process for us, particularly initially with food. My assistant at work was on top of it like that, and within hours of the diagnosis, she had a calendar filled with people who were going to bring us food every day.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was great, except that I had to throw a lot of it out because we couldn't eat all of it or take it to the soup kitchen or something. And so we finally learned to do meals maybe twice a week was usually, frankly, enough. But we had to put some parameters out there. We put out a note early on that said, please don't call us. We'll make posts on Caring Bridge, and we'll let you know how it's going, but please don't call. Ann doesn't want to talk with anyone right now, or whatever it was. We tried to put the message out of what we needed or didn't need, but you have to be willing to let people know. And for people who are offering something that gets turned down, please know that it's appreciated, and don't be offended if they don't need that help at that moment.
You mentioned, Louise, in the last segment that the offer of help sometimes puts another burden on an already burdened patient who is dealing with therapies and the whole idea of where they are in their lives at that moment.
Right.
And sometimes they have to manage everybody else in their lives while they're trying to manage their disease.
Right.
In the break, you referenced a comment in the book, I think it's in the book, where some, I think Anne said, come back when you can't stay so long.
That's the one.
There's another comment in the book that just struck me between the eyes, and that was when she said, she told somebody, if you're thinking about coming back, don't.
Yep.
Now, people like that can get away with it.
That's right.
But that's a fairly shocking comment. How was that taken?
Well, it was actually, that was at a very late stage in her disease. Anne was actually a very open and direct person.
Yes, she was.
Even as a healthy person. But at that point, that was really in a very late stage of her dying process. And so whatever filter she had was
gone.
Was gone. But this was a very close friend who completely understood, and he actually laughed and thought it was just another fun Anne story. But he understood completely. But I think in some ways that was her way of saying goodbye to him.
So I started this program by saying that this book, If There's Anything I Can Do, started as a result of you and Anne taking notes about the helpful things that people said or did to you over the course. When did that start? When did you start writing things down?
I started writing things down, jotting notes down, actually fairly quickly. I mean, within the first month or so. Because I was so struck with the little things like the bag of puzzles left at the door or the friend who called while we were still in the hospital and said, I've just grilled some steaks and I have a plate for you. Come down to the front door of the hospital. She never even got out of the car. She handed me a plate of steak and baked potato for me to eat in the room. Little things like that never would have occurred to me, and I wanted to remember them really for my own reference to help other people who were going through a tough situation.
And Anne also began taking notes, and at one point you had a little joke going back and forth together, did you not, about something would happen and you would say?
Anne would say, put that in the book. I hate it when people do that.
Perfect.
Yep.
Now, a friend of yours started a site for you, and you've already referenced this, on a place called Caring Bridge. What is that?
Caring Bridge is a wonderful website that allows patients and their families to set up a site and post messages, entries on there about what's happening with the diagnosis or with whatever the developments are for the day. You can also post photographs there. And it allows your friends to post notes and messages that you, as the patient and family, can read whenever you're ready to read them, as opposed to a phone call that's coming in or an email. They're just there.
And this is better than Facebook.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's very different.
Yeah. It is very different. Okay. And it allows people to – people can log on whenever and wherever they are. One of our friends was traveling when Ann was in the hospital, and she wrote a note and said, I've just landed in Budapest, and I went straight to an internet cafe to see how you're doing. So it's a really wonderful communication tool both ways.
And it's a way, because you also said the telephone became a problem. And in the book you talk about you wanted to rip the phone cords out of the wall and throw away your cell phone because people were calling all the time. And they're calling because they're concerned and they care and they want to know. But that's just another burden for you. So this is a way to get the word out, to broadcast essentially what's going on, and not have to answer 1,000 people's questions.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. And it let us read the messages from friends when we were ready to read them. And sometimes Anne was so weak, she really didn't want to read me to read to her what people had said. She just wanted to know who had made a post.
Mm.
So I tell people, don't try to be eloquent or worry about what you say in a card or a note or a Caring Bridge post. The fact that you're writing or putting something on there means the world to them.
And it doesn't always have to be about the illness.
No, mm. No.
Do people on the receiving end of this, if I say, you know, took the kids to soccer today and our team won, is that something you want on that Caring Bridge post?
I think I'm going to have to answer that by saying it depends. And another thing I need to make clear is that nothing that I have to say about this is necessarily universal. Every patient is different. Mm-hmm. Every caregiver is different. Every situation is different. And it changes unpredictably. What the patient or family or caregiver need or want at a given moment changes completely unpredictably.
Did you use Caring Bridge when you were going through your ordeal?
I did not, mm-hmm. And in retrospect, that was a mistake, because mm-hmm. it would have been easier for Wendy, for my wife, to handle the communications. I also did my treatment up in Duke, which is where I met Louise, and so I spent about 6 weeks alone up there, and it would have been much easier for me if I'd been able to establish the Caring Bridge relationship for that reason as well. It would have been nice.
How many people use this?
A lot. A lot of people use it, and it's really fabulous.
Can you get a good internet signal in a hospital?
Yes.
Nowadays.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think a thing to think about, which you said also, and I'd like to reiterate, is that we are so individual and unique, and at the same time, there are so many universal similarities among us. And yes, each situation is very individual, and at the same time, if there's anything I can do, is such a brilliant universal assister to people going through something like this. Yeah.
You know, on your point, Louise, I found as the recipient, if a person spoke out of our relationship rather than out of me being sick, then they could say something like, you know, we're at soccer today and the kids won. It would be fabulous, and I'd like that. And it would be – it's a welcome break from yet another how are you, you know, or saying a prayer for you,
right.
Which is all nice. But after a while, you've heard it about 100 times. So, for example, being a smart aleck and a smart aleck with Ann, some of my posts, I was just trying to speak off the sad tone. And I don't, you know, I never heard whether Ann cared, but I was, as much as anything, I was writing to the other people who were posting that, you know, there's more going on here.
Right. And John's right. We knew each other so well that those posts always cheered us up, and mm-hmm. we thought they were funny. And we knew that he cared and wasn't being dismissive or trying to avoid the topic. he was just being John, and we knew John very well. So I think that's a great point. It depends a lot on the relationship.
And you want to sort of normalize, get back to the normal world, the day-to-day. Somehow when someone gets diagnosed with something, they become the cancer. And
right. It's
unfortunate because so much is lost in that, and it feels so frustrating, I've been told.
And that is not just with ordinary people, friends and associates and relationships that you have outside of your normal life. It's with medical people, because you said, John,
yes. That
so often the medical people in your situation just see you as a body that needs to be fixed. There's no human being there.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're there to be cut, zapped, prodded, filled with poison, and then once you're done, you move on to the next stage, whatever, which is usually out of their control. I was fortunate to be able to develop a relationship in some way with my team, but I mean, from my perspective, not only did I have to work at taking care of myself, I brought my notebook, and you got to take notes and keep track, which is something I learned from Josephine.
The size
and,
of the phone
Ann.
Book.
Well, yes. Yeah, I got all the names in there.
Wow.
But I had to work at the relationship. I mean, that's part of the reason I wore my funny hats and wigs, is to try to do something other than just be another body in a gown that's plugged up with an IV.
Speaking of wigs, that's another thing that you bring up in this book, because people who go through cancer treatment quite often lose their hair. And people are trying to bolster them and give them something positive back, and they say, at least it's hair. It'll grow back. And one of you, I don't know whether it's you, Josephine, in the book, or you in the material you gave us, John, said, that is a very bad thing to say.
Yeah.
Maybe it was you, Louise.
I think so.
One of you said this.
Yeah.
It is a very bad thing to say. Anne actually did not lose her hair, the kind of chemo that she had, but I have heard this from others, and I know just instinctively and from knowing people who have been through it, when you lose your hair, especially for a woman who loses her hair, but even for a man,
no one likes to be bald, right?
There would be no such thing as the hair club for men.
Uh-huh.
But when your hair is falling out in chunks, and when you look at yourself in the mirror and see no hair, it's a stark reminder that you are very sick, that your body is full of poison. It's so full of poison it can't even grow hair anymore, and that you have to take that poison in order to try to kill the cancer. So there is nothing lighthearted about losing your hair. It's a very intense and emotional.
So what do you say to somebody who's having to put a wig on or shop for a wig, or who is obviously losing their hair and they haven't gotten the wig yet? What do you say to them?
Louise may be able to speak to that. Her partner actually had breast cancer.
Right, but did not lose her hair. You know, again, I think it's one of those times where I don't know what to say, but I'm here with you.
Yeah.
And we'll get through this somehow.
You know, you talk about while using Caring Bridge, and I think that this could apply to not using Caring Bridge. This could just apply to what you say to people in general, in any setting. You talk about honesty, and you say, do not sugarcoat what's going on. If it's not going well, say so. Why? Because now you're putting the burden on the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Is that why would you want to do that?
Because if you sugarcoat it as a – and I made this mistake with the original Caring Bridge posts, and I tried to be positive, and then people would write in their posts, I'm glad to hear it's going so well. And Anne would say, it is not going well. What are you saying to these people? I'm really sick.
Mm-hmm.
This is really hard. The patient needs for people to understand how sick they are, how scary it is, how hard it is. And so when you as the family member are putting messages out there – you know, you need to be careful. You don't want to put really gross clinical things out on post, but you need to acknowledge that it really is hard, or how weak they are, or how much support they need, so that people will understand that and ideally will be able to respond and acknowledge back how hard it is.
Because you also say, as someone posting comments on Caring Bridge or even talking to you in person or on the phone to the person who is ill, don't just focus on some tiny kernel of a positive nature that you've gleaned from their post. If the post is negative, acknowledge it. Now, that sounds counterintuitive. You would think you want to say, no, things will get better. But you say no. Embrace it.
Because that feels very dismissive to the patient to say, oh, I'm sure the scan will be clean, or it'll get better, or you're going to be fine. You don't know that they're going to be fine, and the patient doesn't know that they're going to be fine. And again, they're scared. They're dealing with a lot. It's very hard. They feel very sick, and they want people to understand that. And often said to me, I want people to know how sick I am.
Mm-hmm. But John, you're really into this. I mean, you're agreeing with this vehemently.
I am. It brought back to me that 2-3 years after I was done with treatment, and I had, by all evidence, been clear of cancer from the time of my surgery, and the treatment was just a bonus.
Awesome. Yeah.
But 3 years later, when I would turn the corner onto the road in Durham to go down to the hospital to get my checkup, all of the fear and uncertainty would come flooding back. And I would have been very positive and all that all the rest of the time. So it's worth just acknowledging that you can be supportive and optimistic, but inside it's a big uncertainty. You can't bet that you're, quote, cancer-free. I don't talk that way.
You've seen this with hundreds, maybe thousands of people because you're a nurse and you deal with this every day. Is honesty the best policy in all directions, coming from the patient and their family to the patient and their family, from the doctors to the patient and their family, and vice versa?
So as Josephine so eloquently said, every situation is different.
Okay.
Every person is different. Certainly who I am, I personally think it's always best to be honest. I mean, certainly I wouldn't walk into a room and say, wow, you look horrible. I might, say that in another way. But I think in every situation, and my therapist will agree, that we all want to be validated of who we are, how we're feeling, what we're going through. And so if I'm going through something awful and you're saying, wow, you look great, let's have a party, that doesn't go together. And so I think honesty is really important, and you don't want to mislead a patient or a family member or a caregiver.
You were brought in on the tail end of this book writing experience. You were kind of asked to look it over and maybe make some suggestions and edits. What went through your mind when you read the first draft?
It resonated so much with me that I was like, I say that all the time. I agree. If you can't see the clock, there's another quote in here about if you aren't aware of the time that the clock is saying, look at my face. Things about doing something. So many things resonated with me, and I loved that it was short, that it was the kind of book that you could just pick up and open up to any page and it would help you out, that it was summarized in the back with lessons. Every section has lessons learned, and it was summarized in the back. I thought it was really universally incredibly helpful.
Louise Goldstein is a registered nurse and clinical care coordinator with Duke Home Care and Hospice. John Munz is a cancer survivor. Josephine Hicks wrote the book that we're talking about. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Creative Loafing. The Iron Fork Chef Competition features 5 Charlotte chefs in a live cooking showdown. Eats, drinks, and entertainment on Wednesday, March 19th. Tickets at clclt.com/events. The Senate approves a bill to strengthen protections for military sexual assault victims, and a Fort Bragg judge refuses to dismiss sex assault charges against an Army general. Guest host Susan Page is in for Diane Rehm today, and she and her guests will discuss the new developments and how military sexual assault cases are handled. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, a terrific place to start is at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Hey, Tommy, I finally found something worthwhile to do with your old cars.
Really?
And it doesn't involve Boston Harbor and a trunk full of bricks. Get this, donate your old car today, and we'll turn it into Morning Edition, Fresh Air, and Car Talk tomorrow.
That's fast.
Well, in your case, we need to move quickly before your car turns to dust. Donate now, you'll get a tax deduction, and we'll even tow it away for free.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Josephine Hicks wrote, "If there is anything I can do, what you can do when serious illness strikes," a collection of notes and experiences that she collected when her partner Anne was going through cancer treatments for pancreatic cancer. John Muntz is here, a cancer survivor, a friend of the two of them, and Louise Goldstein is a friend of John's, who helped him through his ordeal. She's a registered nurse. And your allusion to, "If you can't see the clock, look at my face," is a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote that's actually in the book.
Yes.
We don't have to go through the exact quote, but let me bring up Dennis's email here. Dennis in Morris Hill says, "I have stage 4 prostate cancer. That means I will not survive it. People all say, 'Oh, you'll beat it.' I know better. I'm good with that. My chemo to extend my life starts in a few weeks, and I'm going to need a driver on 3 days. And my dear friend, who always said, 'Let me know if there's anything I can do,' said he'd take me. So he meant it. And as an atheist, I hear, I'll keep you in my prayers all the time. I want to say, clinical trials have proven that prayer will not change the outcome, but I don't. I say thank you."
I say good for him.
Yes.
Good for him that he's acknowledging and open that he is going to die from this cancer. That's a hard thing to acknowledge. It's a hard thing to make clear to your friends, and it's hard for your friends to acknowledge, but it's important.
We alluded to the fact that phone calls can sometimes be very disturbing because they come at all hours, and you can be inundated with them by well-meaning people who just want to know and want you to know that they care and that they're thinking about you. So if you don't get on Caring Bridge and transmit that out to the world, and you really don't want the phone calls because the phone calls are a problem, and you don't want people dropping by the house unannounced, and perhaps the patient is in such a situation in the hospital that they just can't have a flow, a steady stream of people coming through. How do you let people know that? How would I, as a person, a friend of yours, let you know that I am thinking about you and that I do care what happens? And please keep me in the loop. And what can I do? How do we do that?
Eliminated Caring Bridge from your example, because but that would be my answer is one of the best ways to.
Not everybody does that, you know.
You know, as hackneyed as it can sound, I loved getting cards.
So did Anne.
Just simple cards.
Absolutely.
In fact, my favorite one, which my friends now hate the fact that I got, was the Hamster Dance musical card, which I would open up and laugh anytime.
Another great thing to do for people that have voicemail or answer machines is have someone put on the message that people hear when they call your phone. "Hi, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it. Please understand I'm not in a place to receive visitors, but I so appreciate the call." You can leave updates on these messages. You can do it on your cell phone or on your home answer machine. Have a friend put that message on. So when people call, they hear you're okay, but you're not up to this, and you still want to get the message.
And Anne liked to get calls. One of your friends sent a daily postcard with one or two lines on it.
Right. Right, and it was wonderful. And I couldn't begin to tell you what any of those sentences said, but the fact that she was getting a postcard, again, showed that this friend really was thinking about her, wanted to cheer her up, wanted to do something. And cards and handwritten cards and notes are always wonderful.
Can I go back to the gentleman who emailed and spoke about prayer? And although, yes, research, I believe, has shown that people praying for you doesn't necessarily change the clinical outcome of your disease, whatever it might be. But people that know that they are part of a prayer circle, people that know that people are praying for them, feel better and have a better quality of life. And I believe that is accurate.
Because is that because the underlying message there is love?
I don't know, but I would guess.
You wanted to talk about visits.
Visits, such a complicated, important part of being a patient and a caregiver. As we've been talking about this whole time, the people that you know and that love you want to come and see you, and it's really important to realize how tiring that can be for patients and caregivers, and that keeping them brief. You know, who are you visiting the person for, yourself or the patient?
How do you know when to leave? How do you know when you should leave? Because sometimes people say, sit down. Don't leave yet. But they really are tired, and they really would rather not have you there, but they're being polite. How do you know?
Well, if the clock's gone past 10 minutes,
right.
It's time
I
to leave.
I was going to say 5, but anywhere in there, 5 to 10, just know you're in, I love you, here's whatever. And keep it brief. And you can see on the patient's face. And also, if you're lucky enough to be a patient who has a family member or a caregiver or someone that they love, give you the high sign.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that you stress in communication that this is not about you. When you say, is there anything I can do for you, it's about them. It's about the person going through this ordeal. But then you say, if you offer to do something that's easy for you to do, because the easier for you, the less burden it will be for you, and the easier it will be for the person to accept your offer.
Right.
Well, isn't that making it about you then?
Well, yeah. When I say it's not about you, and this is hard, because if you have a close friend who's going through cancer, you have your own fears and concerns and worries and, you know, your own needs. And maybe those needs are, I want to see you. I want to hear your voice. I want to hear how it's going. But you have to remember that for the patient, you don't want to put your burdens and your needs onto the patient. I read a wonderful article after this came out that describes it as and gives the guidance as comfort in, dump out. If you imagine that the patient and their close family members are in the center of a concentric circles, and then the circles come out from there, do everything you can for everything that goes in toward the patient and caregiver to be supportive. And if you need to vent or dump your own needs and concerns, do that outward towards your own friends and support circle. It doesn't help. In the article, it describes a woman who's a patient in a hospital, is going through a terrible time. Her friend wants to come visit, and the patient says, I'm sorry, but I'm really way too sick. And the friend says, well, this is not just about you. I need to see you. Well, I'm sorry, but at that moment it is about the patient and what they need, and you need to calibrate your needs and get them met without putting a burden on the patient.
Well,
that's what I meant by that.
I want to pick up on the visit for the caregiver, not just the patient. Because particularly in my case, I think it was harder on Wendy than it was on me. Because I had a job. I mean, my job was to go through the treatment and follow the rules and, you know, focus in. But there were still times where I wasn't particularly interested in talking or whatever. But she had a need to talk about it. She had a need to see people and to talk through what she was feeling and how the kids were dealing with it and all that kind of thing. So it's not just about me as the patient. It's also about the caregiver.
Yeah, we need to talk about the caregiver because you were a caregiver, I'm sure, for Anne for a good period of time. And Louise, you talk about how nurses learn to take care of themselves because if they don't take care of themselves, they can't take care of their patients. And when you're a caregiver, you have a patient. What would you tell caregivers about taking care of themselves?
It's a learned process. And it's hard to do because naturally caregivers are giving care, and we tend to ignore ourselves. But the fact of the matter is you have to find some time for yourself in
And that may mean being out with friends or having friends come in away from the hospital, away from the ill
person. It might.
Just
right.
to relieve the pressure.
And it also might be 5 minutes in a different room or sitting outside and getting fresh air for just 5 minutes, which can be really incredibly helpful, mm-hmm. 5 quiet minutes to yourself or doing some mindfulness meditation or some relaxation breathing or something. But for Wendy, it's just excruciating being the caregiver. It really is. And she did a magnificent job.
You also talk, Louise, about when you go to see somebody, mm-hmm. a patient, just being there, mm-hmm. is what is important. You don't have to try to fix the situation. You just
right.
have to be there to let people know that you care. Well, That led me to think about gender differences in the approach to this, because men like to fix things. Mm-hmm. And if they can't fix it, they feel relatively worthless, because that's what we do. So are women better at this than men? And because plus women talk, men grunt. So I mean,
melodiously, but yes, grunt. Yes.
I know a lot of really wonderful men who are very good at being there. Mm-hmm. When I was a brand new nurse, a veteran nurse said to me, "Don't just do something, be there." And I had an exercise. She put me through an exercise that every day, at some point during the day, I had to go into the patient's room and just sit there and not do anything. And if anyone has struggles with that technique, they should give it a shot. And being there is, I think, one of the most important things, quietly, silently, without ego, because that's what's driving so many of the actions. And just being there with somebody is an incredible gift.
Silence. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
I want to pick up on your man fixing thing, because mm-hmm. the other thing that we do is we go do things. And one of the things that Anne and I developed in her remission periods is we would go do yoga. We would go do something. And it was the same point. The point was to be with her and to break the routine of worrying about being sick or not. But I found for myself as well, a couple of buddies would stop by. You know, I'm in the area. Are you up for supper tonight? And that was a great suggestion, because then we could go do something, got me out of the apartment. I wasn't doing the regular routine, and I didn't have to talk about being sick all the time with them. We could talk about other stuff.
I wanted to go into that with you, because you mentioned that in some of the notes that you sent over here. You don't have to talk about the illness. You can talk about other things in the world, and in fact, you'd like to talk about other things in the world.
Right. I like to be able to – it's like the job. I like to be able to acknowledge what's going on. Yeah, I had treatment today, blah, 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 blah. This was a bad week. This is a good week, whatever. But now let's talk about something else.
How about those Panthers?
Yeah, how about the Panthers? You know, is Smitty going to stay around? You know, that.
And silence, you write, Josephine. Silence is not a bad thing.
That's right. That's right. And again, nothing's universal, and it will depend on the situation. But if you let the patient set the tone – then you'll be fine. Again, if you go in the room and you just sit there and are silent, if that's what the patient wants, that's what will happen. If the patient wants to talk, they'll strike up a conversation with you. So let them take the lead.
And the other thing you talk about, I think, is it's not just about – and maybe this will help people who don't know what to say. It's not about saying things. It's about listening.
That's exactly right. Mm. That's exactly right. And if you do want to say something, ask an open-ended question. Again, tell me about it, or – something that will let them set the tone and let them talk.
Shannon called for her friend who was ill. She set up a Facebook page, she says. It was a good way to let people know she was ill, and she wanted to hear from people but didn't want to talk on the phone or have people come by. The Facebook page was a good way for people to interact mm-hmm. with her. What's it called? The Caring Bridge. How do you get to that? Is that just caringbridge.com?
Caringbridge.org, I think it is. And you go on. It's very easy to set up the website, although a friend actually did it for me
right.
before Ann went into the hospital. But I've set one up for someone too. It's very easy to do.
Obviously, if you're going to put things on Facebook or you're going to put things on Caring Bridge, the concern for privacy is not paramount. But what about that? What if you don't want the entire world to know everything? You just want a coterie of friends to understand what's really going on here.
Well, then you control what you put on Caring Bridge or what you put on Facebook. And if you want only certain people to know certain messages, you send those to them through phone calls or emails or a more limited way of putting the message out there.
Zach in Charlotte writes, great broadcast. I know Anne was a big Scrabble fan. Please talk about the Spell the End to Cancer event. What a fun way to defeat cancer.
Yeah.
You've planted a plug on this program. Go ahead.
Anne loved playing Scrabble and loved all things about words. She was a devotee of the New York Times crossword puzzle. And so after she died and I wanted to do something to raise money for cancer research, we started an event called Spell the End of Cancer. John was involved in helping me put it together, and we play Scrabble and word games, and John's our MC, and we have a lot of fun and raise money for cancer research.
How often does this go on?
Once a year. So the next event is November the 1st of this year, and everyone's welcome. We have a website, spelltheendofcancer.com. We also have a Facebook page at Spell the End of Cancer, so come join us.
Jason writes, having gone through what your guests have experienced as a caregiver, I want to point out some very important experience. My wife was diagnosed with a cancer that eventually took her life. One of the things that I most remember was our friend stopping by and simply taking me away from the situation for a few minutes. A couple would stop by and one would stay with her while the other kidnapped me for a cup of coffee or just a walk, anything to get me out of the situation for just a few minutes. It did more than I ever realized at the time just to have a brief opportunity to talk to someone, mentally refresh and reset. It made me a better caregiver and help me to survive. And you're all nodding.
Absolutely. That is so important. Great. I'll tell you, one of the best pieces of advice I got early on is that I was the only person who could be the spouse. Anyone can do the laundry or pick up a prescription or prepare a meal. But I was the only one who could play that role for Anne. And that's true for any caregiver. So as much as it feels like you ought to be doing everything and you want to take care of everything, you need to let other people take care of what they can so that you can stay strong and sane and play the role that only you can play.
Josephine Hicks, a partner at Parker Poe Adams and Bernstein, lost her partner to cancer and as a result wrote this book, If There's Anything I Can Do, What You Can Do When Serious Illness Strikes, an easy read and an important book. Louise Goldstein, a registered nurse and clinical care coordinator with Duke Home Care and Hospice, and John Bunce, a friend, a patient, and a cancer survivor. Thank you all for the hour.